The final chapter of the first canto. In the previous chapter, we saw something very unfortunate occur. And that unfortunate occurrence was the cursing of the great Maharaj, the great king, Maharaj Brigit, by the Brahmin boy. And we heard three different explanations of this. One, it was Kali had influenced this Brahmin boy, so it was his foolishness. Second, or rather that one will there was the Kali influencing the boy, then the second it was the pride of the Brahmanas, and third, we could say it was due to the fault of Maharaj Prickett, because he inappropriately acted towards the great sage Samyaka Rishi. But ultimately we heard that this occurrence was the pastime desire of Krishna. Krishna wanted something done. So which was it? Was it the pride of the Brahmin boy? Was it Kali? Was it Prickett Maharaj's fault? Or was it Krishna's desire? Ultimately, the final word is that it is Krishna's desire. But when we look at the occurrence from different points of view to draw out different lessons, to understand different philosophical points that will improve our own behavior, different instructions the Bhagavatam is meant to give us, we can also see it from these other points. We can learn to beware pride, regardless of our learning, our power, etc. We should beware pride, and we should understand the, looking at it from the Vanashrama point of view, we should understand the mutual dependence of the Brahminical class upon the Kshatriya class. Without the Brahmins, without the head-on society, society won't have a proper direction. But without the rulers, the organizers of society, just to have a head, the head will just float around with ideas and principles, but it won't practically manifest in the proper direction of society. It won't be practical. So there has to be that respect in Vanashram. And actually in the third canto, which we should start reading before the end of the year, if Krishna allows, we'll see this. We'll see that when Swayambhuva Manu meets the sage Kardama Muni, so much complimentary respect is given from one to the other. And this is actually the hallmark of culture and of any properly working society, is that people respect each other for their contribution, because no one person can do everything. So in Vedic civilization, as really is summarized by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu with Trinadapi Sunitsena Tarodapi Sisnana Amanina Manadena Kirtaniya Sadahari, that one should be willing to give respect to others, to acknowledge what the other person is doing of benefit, and not wish to take respect for oneself. And this is actually the key for cooperation, or a key for cooperation. See the good in others, and don't draw attention to what one is doing. So we learn Vanashrama lessons. What a disaster occurs, even though the head is properly, more we can say, is in a higher position. The Brahmins are in a higher position than the Kshatriyas, which are compared to the arms. Still, As soon as there is pride, everything is ruined. If the pride comes to the Kshatriyas, they think, oh, by my power, everything is going on. Who needs anyone else? Who is a Kshatriya who is in that mood? Maharaj Vena. Caused horrible results. Or, if one becomes a wealthy mercantile person and a Vaishya and starts thinking, look at these poor, these brahmanas, these sannyasis, when they want something, they're praying to God all day long, but when they want something, where do they go? They go to me to get their money, etc. So therefore, who is higher, me or God? Basically, that's how people start thinking. So as soon as there is pride, everything is lost. And then as soon as there's pride, Krishna may allow us to expand for some time like a balloon. But when the balloon gets too full of hot air, pop, it's finished. And then there's nothing. Practically, it was so big. And then when it pops, there's practically nothing left because it was mostly composed of air. So we learn that very strongly from this. And we also learn how Kali, how insidious Kali is. How Kali specifically makes quarrel. Using pride, self-righteousness, makes quarrel and ruins society. Through irreligiousness, etc. And then finally we learn about Krishna's desire. When Krishna wants something, he uses his devotees to accomplish it. And although it may look like the most unfortunate occurrence, as it looked like with the king, it looked like for him he lost everything, for the citizens, they lost their king. It looked like Kali had triumphed. But ultimately, because it was Krishna's desire, and not a blade of grass moves without the sanction of Krishna, because it was Krishna's desire, we can know it will turn out wonderful. When Krishna wants something, it must be wonderful. And the devotee's business is to cooperate with Krishna's desire. And the chanting of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra is that prayer to be able to serve Krishna, to have one's desire inflamed for service, so it burns to ashes, one's independent desire for enjoyment. This is how a devotee thinks. And we'll see this characterized in the life of Maharaj Prickett, because we want to watch him very closely right now. Because seemingly the most horrible thing has happened to him. How will he react to it? The king who possessed power, unrivaled wealth, unrivaled opulence, position, suddenly, in one moment, practically speaking, he learns that in 7 days he's going to lose it all. Now, how is he going to deal with this? How will he react? We want to watch him because he is our acharya. He is our teacher. And Krishna, through him, will teach us how to deal with even the most horrific reverses in our life. Because what could be worse than this? Leaving aside family, leaving aside wealth, leaving aside position, just like that. What could be worse? So this has to happen in life. We will lose things. Life must treat us. Just the nature of one's karma. It's always changing and it can't always be good. It just can't be. It's impossible. because there are always friends and enemies, and there's always the change of time changes friend, a good situation into a bad, and a bad to a good. It just must be like that. So how to deal with the ups and downs of life, we will learn from Maharaj Prickett, and especially how to deal with the ultimate disaster of life that everyone fears, and which comes stalking us like a thief in the night, and that is death, and one never knows when it's going to come. So how to deal with that when suddenly we find there's a knock on the door and we say, who is it? And the answer is, it's death. Or how to deal with that, Maharaj Prickett will teach us. So the last part of the story that we heard was when Maharaj Prickett, he put the garland on the boy, on the father, Samikarishi. The boy had cursed him, and then the boy went to his father crying, because he knew he had done something wrong. The father woke up, saw the snake around his neck, just tossed it away as insignificant. And when the father heard what had happened, he thought this was a horrible occurrence, because the king, for a slight offense, was given such a heavy punishment, death. So he sent the message to Maharaj Prickett of what had happened, told him to prepare. So Maharaj Prickett, on the other hand, as the first verse describes in the 19th chapter, describes, rather than thinking after he had done this, before he had heard what the boy Sringi had done in retaliation, even before he had heard that, he was feeling terrible. This is the mark of a good person. When he does something improperly, he feels bad about it. So he began to lament that he had done something improper to a Brahmin, because even though he was a king, and when one usually thinks of a king, one thinks of the top position. But in the Vedic culture, the king was not in the top position. Rather, the Brahmins were in the top position, because they gave direction to the king. They gave spiritual direction. They made sure that the king, due to the influence of the mode of passion, because the king must control, he must be powerful, he must deal with money, he must deal with rajniti, politics. He has Ishwara Bhav, leadership. So the tendency, because he has to deal with these things, is to become overwhelmed by passion. So therefore, division of labor was instituted within the society. So in addition to the king, there were the Brahmins, who made sure that the proper direction, that Krishna, not the king, was the center. Although the king was allowed sense enjoyment, certainly. But yet, he himself could not be made the center. Krishna, the spiritual upliftment of the citizens, had to be the center of the king's activities. So the Brahmins were there. So therefore, the Kshatriyas, according to the culture, the rulers, had to respect the Brahmanas. They must respect the Brahmanas. So when he did something, when Maharaj Prickett did something whimsical, even though it was insignificant, but disrespectful to a Brahmin, he felt distress. He felt it was heinous, horrible act, and quite uncivilized. So, this is something that we should learn. He immediately started lamenting and repenting his activity. Prabhupada explained in the purport, I'll read it because it's so important for all of us. Very short and to the point. The pious king regretted his accidental, improper treatment of a powerful Brahmana who was faultless. And again, it was accidental. Accidental means he didn't. It was done circumstantially, rather than it was premeditated or something habitual. He didn't do this thing regularly. He didn't, when he saw sages garland them with snakes. It was just some circumstance. So he began to regret it, what he had done. Such repentance. In other words, he didn't think, anyway, just something that happened. Anyway, I was thirsty. Anyway, this. Anyway, what's the difference? Anyway, I won't do that again. I never did it before. Anyway, this. Anyway, that. No. I'm the king. He might have been disrespecting me. No. Such repentance is natural for a good man like the king. And such repentance delivers a devotee from all kinds of sins accidentally committed. The devotees are naturally faultless. Accidental sins committed by a devotee are sincerely regretted. And by the grace of the Lord, all sins unwillingly committed by a devotee are burnt in the fire of repentance. So Maharaj Prickett began to think, due to my neglecting the injunctions of the Supreme Lord, I must certainly expect some difficulty to overcome me in the near future. I now desire, without reservation, that the calamity may come now, for in this way I may be freed of the sinful action and not commit such an offense again. He wasn't thinking, oh, anyway, I'm a devotee, Krishna will protect me. No, he wanted the reaction to come. And he explains, and Prabhupada explains in his purport, three reasons why the reaction should be welcome. The first, as described, is very unselfish. That let it come to me so it doesn't disturb my family members, those who are attached to me. Let it come now. Second, if I have to suffer, it will stop me, it will purify me and stop me from committing future sins. So it's a good lesson. Now this is the mark, this way of thinking is the mark of good students who learn their lessons. They see their own faults and they think of reasons why what has happened is good for me. And then again, he wanted that when one does something sinful, there's a reaction. So let the reaction come, and then the sinful reaction is finished. I deserve it. It's good for me. So he was thinking like this. Just criticizing himself. He said in text 3, I am uncivilized and sinful due to my neglect of Brahminical culture. He wasn't his own lawyer saying, anyway, this is just one time. No, he really was. He was very hard on himself. I'm uncivilized, sinful due to my neglect of Brahminical culture, God consciousness and cow protection. Therefore, I wish that my kingdom's strength and riches burn up immediately by the fire of the Brahmana's wrath, so that in the future I may not be guided by such inauspicious attitudes. So he really didn't want, as Srila Jiva Goswami explains, he didn't want the kingdom to burn up. He didn't want anything to happen to others that was bad, but he wanted these things to be taken from him so he would learn his lesson. He was actually saying, the best thing for me at this point was that I become bereft of my riches, of my strength, of my kingdom, so I will learn my lesson. This was before he even found out about the curse. He was lamenting. And text 4, While the king was thus repenting, he received news of his imminent death, which would be due to the bite of a snake bird, occasioned by the curse spoken by the sage's son. The king accepted this as good news, for it would be the cause of his indifference towards worldly things. Prabhupada's purport. The path of perfection frees one from all material attachment. And thus one who becomes fit to enter into the spiritual kingdom. Therefore, those who are materially poverty-stricken are better candidates than those who are materially prosperous. Maharaj Prickett was a great devotee of the Lord and a bona fide candidate for entering into the kingdom of God. But even though he was so, his material assets as the emperor of the world were setbacks to perfect attainment of his rightful status as one of the associates of the Lord in the spiritual sky. Because it's natural, if you have family members, if you have wealth, beauty, power, position, animals, anything, whatever one is surrounded by, one becomes attached to that thing. And as long as we are attached to anything material, this acts as anchors that keep us in the material world. So Maharaj Prickett was thinking, this is good. When I learn that I'm going to die, this is the mercy of Krishna, the mercy of God. So I will give up all this insignificant material attachment. But how deep does one's realization have to be before one can actually think like this? It is not superficial. It is not something... It can easily come off the tongue. So the time of death will actually test each and every one of us as to the depth of our realization. And it's no joke. No joke in the sense of the test is a serious one. And there is no cheating or bluffing on this test. I remember when we were in school, I remember two incidents. One when I was in junior high school. I remember there was some course I was taking in hygiene or something. And it was talking about the skin. And it said, that the skin is a germ-proof layer around the body. But in my notes, I didn't write it properly, instead of writing germ-proof, G-E-R-M, I wrote down G-E-M, gem-proof. And sure enough, on the test, the teacher asked, what is the function of the skin in relation to the body? And I wrote down it was gem-proof. And the teacher said, oh, very good. Bluff! I didn't know what gem proof was. And yet... And I remember also in the university, higher knowledge means higher bluff. Because the rule is, if you have an essay question and you don't know the answer, it means you write more. Just write, fill up the page, as many pages as you can. First principle is that the teacher will be overwhelmed by so many tests. So if he sees so long answer, he thinks, oh, he must know so much. Second principle in that is, that you're thinking is, that will make him tired. Third principle is, maybe something will be true in all the garbage I write. Something may be there. You never can tell what will come out. And also, I've heard teachers say this, and of course it sounds like something that they're joking, but they don't smile when they say it. But the teachers, to mark the papers, they take it, they stand on the top of the steps, and they throw the papers. And the ones that are heavier will land on the higher steps, and they get the higher grades. And the ones that are lighter, they'll go further down, and they get lower grades. So this is a good combination, the people who bluff and the teachers who don't want to read the... And then you also write in bad handwriting, so they can't read it even if they don't want to. And then you can always, when they give you a low grade, you can criticize and say, but I said this, and but I said that. What language did you say it in? That's the question. But the test at the time of death, there is no bluff. There is no bluff, because what our consciousness is truly attached to, regardless of what we have done externally, will come out. So Maharaj Prickett truly thought, deeply realized that this was good for me because I've lost everything material. Everything. So as a devotee of the Lord, the king could understand that the cursing of the Brahmana boy, although unwise, was a blessing upon him, being the cause of detachment from worldly affairs, both political and social. Shamika Rishi, Shamika Muni also, after regretting the incident, conveyed the news to the king as a matter of duty, that the king, so that the king would be able to prepare himself to go back home, back to God. Shamik Muni sent news to the king that foolish Sringi, his son, although a powerful Brahmana boy, unfortunately had misused his spiritual power by cursing the king unwarrantedly. The incident of the king's garlanding the Muni was not sufficient cause for being cursed to death. But since there was no way to retract the curse, the king was informed to prepare for death within a week. Both Shamik Muni and the king was self-realized soul. Samak Muni was a mystic and Maharaj Prickett was a devotee. Therefore, there was no difference between them in self-realization. Neither of them was afraid of meeting death. Maharaj Prickett could have gone to the Muni to beg his pardon, but the news of imminent death was conveyed to the king with so much regret by the Muni that the king did not want to shame the Muni further by his presence there. He decided to prepare himself for his imminent death and find out the way to go back to Godhead. Find out the way to go back to Godhead. This is the action of an intelligent person. So what did he do? Again, we are watching this person deal as an exemplar, deal with the most difficult of all situations. Maharaj Prickett, what did he do? He sat down firmly on the bank of the Ganga to concentrate his mind in Krishna consciousness. That's what he did. He rejecting all other practices of self-realization, because transcendental loving service to Krishna is the greatest achievement, superseding all other methods. So he became very determined to practice devotional service with vyavya satmika buddhi, with one-pointed fixed intelligence, ekeha guru nandana, fixed one-pointed devotion. And he wanted determinedly to attain the fruit of that devotion was prema bhakti, loving service to Krishna, and go back home, back to Godhead, because he understood that there is no place, no situation within the material world that is suitable for a devotee. And all souls are devotees. There is no place within the material world which is natural, comfortable, trouble-free, satisfying. Brahma bhuvana loka puna avitano arjuna. Whatever place we can imagine, from the highest, whatever situation, in this world or in all the worlds, there is no place, material place, that is suitable for a devotee. So he sat down firmly on the bank of the Ganga and actually it wasn't the Ganga, although the verses explain it was the Ganga. It was actually the Jamuna. Srila Jiva Goswami has made this clear, and he quoted from the Varaha Purana, which I didn't bring the quote with me, although I have it. The Ganga and the Jamuna are the same because both have touched the lotus feet of the Lord. The Ganga has touched the lotus feet of the Lord when the Lord appeared as Vamanadeva, and in later days it has touched the lotus feet of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And the Jamuna has touched the lotus feet tinged with tulsi of Krishna, first when Krishna was being carried across the Jamuna from Gokul to Mahavan, from Mathura to Gokul by Vasudev. Krishna, by his own arrangement, fell into the water. And also Krishna bathed in the Yamuna and played in the Yamuna and took his cows to the Yamuna and sported in the Yamuna and boated in the water and had so many pastimes in the Yamuna River. So the Yamuna is considered 100 times more holy and sanctified than even the Ganga. And because the Yamuna is so close to Hastinapur, where this occurred, the cursing and where Maharaj Prickett was ruling from, Jiva Goswami has concluded that he actually took shelter on the bank of the Ganga, of the Jamuna. So he decided, this was his vow, that I'm not going to do anything. I'm going to sit at this holy place. I will not eat, I will not sleep, I will not even drink water. I will just simply give myself Atma Samarpanam. I will give myself to the lotus feet of Krishna, who alone, the verse says, is able to award liberation. This is wonderful. The giving up of oneself to Krishna. One doesn't become Krishna. One doesn't merge in with Krishna. The one fully surrenders to Krishna. One fully surrenders to Krishna and makes his desires one with Krishna. With Krishna's desires. Kutosto akshara uchate. This is called surrender. Placing oneself fully in Krishna's protection. You do with me as you want, Krishna. I am yours. And from my side, I will focus my consciousness on you and act only for your pleasure. So freeing himself from all kinds of association and attachments, he accepted the vows of a sage. So what stages did he go through in his preparation for death or in his dealing with calamities? So first thing, he saw his own faults and lamented them, repented, compunction it is called. Second, he became very detached from material, from the world of matter, because especially at the time of death or even in life, it's the attachment to matter. Not, we think that this thing causes me trouble and that thing causes me trouble, but actually none of these, nothing external causes us trouble. And this really will be seen at the moment of death, which every one of us will one day have to confront. But the only thing causes us trouble is the attachments of the mind to matter, to those things which are not ours and which are not us. This is what causes us trouble. If someone is detached, he can walk through this world doing so many things and not doing anything. This is described in the Bhagavad Gita, akarma. The devotee acts in the material world and there's no reaction because he doesn't do anything. Krishna works through him. And due to his non-attachment, he accrues no reactions to his work. This is wonderful. This consciousness comes when one has deep, deep devotion to Krishna. So Maharaj Prickett focused his mind on that devotion, gave himself up to the lotus feet of Krishna. He detached himself from everything material and accepted the vows of a sage. He was doing this also because he wanted to become free from the sin. Let the reaction come, but I don't want the sin to taint me. And if one becomes a devotee, Krishna protects one from all sins. And Prabhupada quotes in his purport a verse from the Bhagavatam, Sopara mulam bhajata prayasya taktani abhavasya hari paresha vikama yat so patitam katanchit dunoti sarvam medisanavista. That Krishna within the heart, from one who is a devotee, Sopara mulam bhajata prayasya, one who is doing bhajan, one who has devotion to the lotus feet of Krishna, then Krishna, even if he commits some fault accidentally, commits some mistake, something sinful, some vikarma, then Krishna from within his heart completely removes that sin. This is how Krishna specially takes care of his devotees. So at this point, Maharaj Prickett gave himself completely to Krishna. Of course, he was already given completely to Krishna. But the time of his life had shifted to serving Krishna in a different way. Because we think, we all tend to be in the illusion that, like children, when they're growing up in a house, they think they'll never move. They'll never live. They'll never leave that house. But they do. They go on in their life. They get married. They get a job. They move here. They get pushed there. So every situation we're in will change. This is the very nature of the world. We have to be ready to adjust to Krishna's desire in all the changes, very happily, willingly, devotionally, and with detachment. So when the great sages heard from all over the universe, they heard that this great devotee Maharaj Prickett had renounced his kingdom and was sitting on the bank of the Ganga, awaiting for the curse to enact itself within 7 days, they all came to surround him and to give him that association at the time of his death. This was their mercy. Here the names of the sages are mentioned in several verses 9 and 10 and 11 too. From different parts of the universe, there arrive great sages like Atri, Chayavan, Saradwan, Aristanemi, Bhrigu, Vishishta, Parasara, Vishramita, Angira, Parasaram, Utaya, Indraprad, Idmavahu, Medha Titi Devala, Aristena, Bharadwaj, Gotam, Pipalad, Maitreya, Urva, Kavas, Kumbayani, Dvapayan, means Vyasadev, and the great personality, Narada. There were also many other saintly demigods, kings, and special royal orders called Arunadayas, some type of Rajarshi, great king, from different dynasties of sages. When they all assembled together to meet Maharaj Prickett, he received them properly and bowed his head to the ground. Now, this is another point. As it gets closer to death, we have to break the tendency to have friends and enemies in this world. Because our friends wish us well, and what do our enemies wish us? They wish us harm. Now, when one is dying, about to leave this world, the last thing that one wants is someone to be wishing him harm. Remember that time when you did this to me? Well, here's the time now, when you're helpless. It's the time to get even. You hurt me? Remember that you hurt me? You didn't care for my needs? Now I don't care for you. Die. Go to a bad place. So to remove this, and this is very important, not that we should offend people in our life and then at the end of our life ask everyone for forgiveness, slap everyone in the face for day after day, year after year, and then finally say, and every time we do it, say, I'm sorry, slap, I'm sorry, slap, I'm sorry, slap, I'm sorry. No. But yet, even Prabhupada, in the last days of his life, asked to be forgiven for any offenses that he may have committed. Not that he committed offenses, but this is the mood of a Vaishnava and an intelligent person. So Prabhupada, in a short purport, explains it very clearly. The system of bowing the head to the ground to show respect to superiors is an excellent etiquette which obliges the honored guest deep into the heart. Even the first great offender is excused simply by this process. And Maharaj Prickett, although honored by all the rishis and kings, welcomed all the big men in that humble etiquette in order to be excused from any offenses. Generally, at the last stage of one's life, this humble method is adopted by every sensible man in order to be excused before departure. In this way, Maharaj Prickett implored everyone's goodwill for going back home, back to Godhead. Please bless me, he is saying to the sages. So everyone sat themselves, and Maharaj stood before them with folded hands, and he told them that he had decided to fast until death, not eat, not drink, not sleep, until he would die. Now, in text 13 through 16, there are these verses describe the words of Maharaj Prickett, and they really reveal his mind and to what is important. So let's listen to them carefully. The fortunate king said, "Indeed, we are the most grateful of all the kings who are trained to get favor from the great souls." Because he was so thrilled, so moved, taken aback, that these sages had come to be with him just as he was going to leave this world. Especially, as he says, because generally you sages consider royalty as refuse to be rejected and left in a distant place. Mahaprabhu, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu set this example. He would not meet Maharaj Pratyaparudra. Because even though Pratyaparudra was a great devotee, he was a king, and kings deal with wealth, with women, with power, with politics again. So generally, sages who do not wish to become contaminated by these things, to have these desires for these things, for power, for wealth, money, etc., to awaken in their heart, they avoid the kings, the royalty, like the plague. Worse than the plague, because the plague can kill your body. But material desires can kill your soul, in the sense that it can force the soul to take hundreds of millions of new bodies. So he thought, you sages, out of your... I was a king, and sages keep away from kings, but yet you have come to me despite that fact. Now, of course, Maharaj Prickett wasn't just a king. He was an exalted personality. Remember, Vishnu Ratta. He was personally protected by Krishna while he was still within the womb. So he wasn't a king. He was a devotee, an exalted devotee. But yet, this is how he thought of himself. And he thought, why have the sages come? It is because my forefathers were great devotees. And out of their affection for the Pandavas, for Arjun, for Yudhisthira, Bhishma, out of their affection for these great devoted Mahatmas, personalities, they have come to help me, their useless descendant. So that was the first thing that he said, very humble. Then he said, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the controller of both the transcendental and mundane worlds, has graciously overtaken me in the form of a Brahmana's curse. So what did he see as the underlying... In this most unfortunate circumstance, he saw Krishna, and that vision turned the circumstance around in his sight. So he saw it as fortunate, because how could Krishna do something that meant him harm? Due to my being too much attached to family life, the Lord, in order to save me, He has appeared before me in such a way that only out of fear I will detach myself from the world. So he saw this occurrence as Krishna. To turn him around from his material... Of course, he didn't have material attachment. But see this exalted vision that Krishna has come in this form. This is wonderful. Apitulyarta darshanam. This is why the devotee can be equal in all circumstances, because in all circumstances he sees Krishna and Krishna's hand and Krishna's personal dealings with him. And he especially understood this because Krishna's mark of favor was the presence of these devotees, these exalted personalities. That's how the association of devotees is Krishna's gift. O Brahmanas, just accept me as a completely surrendered soul, and let Mother Ganges, the representative of the Lord, also accept me in that way. For I already have taken the lotus feet of the Lord into my heart, let the snake bird or whatever magical thing the Brahmana created, let it bite me at once. I only desire that you all continue singing the deeds of Lord Vishnu. In other words, he, as Prabhupada explains, the atmosphere created, as soon as one is given up completely unto the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord, he is not at all afraid of death. Because he sees only Krishna. The atmosphere created by the presence of the great devotees of the Lord on the bank of the Ganges and Maharaj Prickett's complete acceptance of the Lord's lotus feet was sufficient guarantee to the king for going back to Godhead. He thus became absolutely free from all fear of death. And then the final verse in his words. And these are really essential. Each one of these verses, these four verses, have such essential, important instructions for us on how to live and how our death can mean real life. Again, in text 16, Punas Chabuyad Bhagavat Tanante, again offering my obeisances unto all you Brahmanas, I pray that if I should again take my birth in the material world, if I shall again take my birth in the material world, now what situation is he, would he request by their grace, by their blessings? I will have complete attachment to the unlimited Lord Krishna. Two, I will have association with his devotees. And three, and friendly relations with all living beings. Attachment to Krishna, association with devotees, and goodwill towards everyone. Goodwill towards everyone comes easily to someone who has attachment to Krishna, because he has no envious, he has no envy in his heart. And he has something to give them. His goodwill takes the form of helping them, removing their ignorance, giving them light of spiritual knowledge. So Prabhupada explains this very nicely in the purport. As a good son of the father behaves in a friendly way with all his other brothers, so also the devotee of the Lord, being a good son of the Supreme Father, Lord Krishna, sees all other living beings in relationship with the Supreme Father. He tries to bring back the upstarts, the naughty sons of the Father, to a saner stage and to get them to accept the Supreme Fatherhood of God. So he was going back to Godhead, Prabhupada explains, certainly, but even if he were not to go back, he prayed for a pattern of life which is the most perfect way in the material world. Those three points. Attachment to Krishna, association with devotees, and goodwill and actions on that level towards all living beings. So after reciting these, making these four, we could call them declarations, or we could call them invoking the mercy of the Brahmana sages who were there, he sat down on a seat of straw with straw roots. This is kush, auspicious, very auspicious straw. He sat down on a seat of kusha grass with straw roots facing the east, placed in the southern bank of the Ganga, and he himself faced the north. Just previously, he had given the charge of his kingdom to his son. So he was ready now. The sages were there, sat down, all material responsibilities finished. He sat, ready to fast until death. All the demigods of the higher planets praised the king's actions and in pleasure continually scattered flowers over the earth and beat celestial drums. I wanted to read a few of the songs of Bhaktivinod Thakur, which also evoke the proper mood of repentance, what to pray for, what to want, what not to want, and how to approach old age and death. I'll read them. Hear, O Lord, there are prayers to the Lord, my story of sadness. I drank the deadly poison of worldliness, pretending it was nectar. And now the sun is setting on the horizon of my life. I spent my childhood in play, my youth in academic pursuit. And in me there arose no sense of right or wrong. In young manhood I set up a household and settled down to the spell of the material enjoyment. Children and friends quickly multiplied. Soon old age arrived and all my happiness departed. Subjected to disease, troubled and weak, all my senses are feeble now. My body racked and exhausted. And my spirits downcast in the absence of youthful pleasures. Devoid of even a particle of devotion, lacking any enlightenment, what help is there for me now? Only you, O Lord, friend of the fallen. I am certainly fallen, the lowest of men. Please therefore lift me to your lotus feet. Were you to judge me now, you would find no good qualities. Have mercy and judge me not. Cause me to drink the honey of your lotus feet and thereby deliver this Bhaktivinod. How much more shall I tell you of my shameful story? There is no sin which I have not committed thousands and thousands of times. My life in this world has been one of affliction and torment as a result of those sins. Whom will I blame but myself? At the time, I did not consider the consequences. Now, in the aftermath, I seek to be saved. After judging my sins, you should punish me. For I deserve to suffer the pangs of rebirth in this world. I only pray that as I wander through repeated births and deaths, my mind may ever dwell at your lotus feet in the company of the Vaishnavas. My heart's false pride has gone far away. O you who are so kind to the meek, your pure mercy has become Bhaktivinod's only hope. At your feet, which are soft as new-grown leaves, I offer this humble prayer. Those feet shelter the fallen souls who burn from the heat of material existence. But I gave up their shelter, and now my mind, scorched by the fire of worldliness, has dried up like a desert. I find no strength to go on, and thus I spend my days lamenting. My only desire now is for your lotus feet, O Lord of the meek and humble. Has there ever been a soul as forlorn as me? Please be merciful and award me the association of your devotees, for by tasting the pleasure of hearing your pastimes, I shall give up all evil. One hope animates my soul, to spend day and night in your divine abode, singing your holy name. Your tiny servant Bhaktivinod begs a place in the delightfully cooling shade of your feet.
Das Song. A wicked mind brought me into this world, O Lord. But one of your pure and elevated devotees has come to bring me out. He saw me so fallen and wretched. He took pity and he came to me saying, O humbled soul, please listen to this good tiding, for it will gladden your heart. Sri Krishna Chaitanya has appeared in the land of Navadvip to deliver you. He has safely conducted many miserable souls such as you across the sea of worldly existence. To fulfill the promise of the Vedas, the son of a Brahmana, bearing the name Mahaprabhu of golden complexion, has descended with his brother, the Avadhuta Nityananda. Together, they have overwhelmed all of Nadia with divine ecstasy. Sri Chaitanya, who is Krishna himself, the son of Nanda, has saved the world by freely distributing his own holy name. Go also and receive your deliverance. O Lord, hearing those words, Bhaktivinoda has come weeping to the soles of your lotus feet and tells the story of his life. One more. I have earned neither piety nor knowledge. Overwhelmed by sensual pleasures, I have cheated myself and now see only darkness in all directions. You, O Lord, are the fountainhead of all mercy. I surrender myself at your lotus feet. Kindly show me your compassion. It is your promise that one who takes refuge in you will know no dangers or fear. For a sinner like me, there is no other shelter. I beg you now for infinite grace. Oh, when will I know freedom from desire and thus become yours? You are eternally to be served. I am your eternal servant. And that is the sum of Bhaktivinoda's devotional mood. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur ki jai. Sri Maharaj Prakrit ki jai. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Gaur Premanandi Hari Hari Bol. Gaur Bhaktivinoda ki jai. So tomorrow we'll finish this 19th chapter and hear what arrangement Krishna has made for Maharaj Prakriti.